ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, Sarah Kanoski here. I recently sat down for a conversation with the former Prime Minister of New Zealand, Jacinda Ardern. We talked about her upbringing as a good Mormon girl, her unusual path into political leadership, and how she navigated some of the most terrible events in the history of New Zealand.
I felt such rage that part of the way they designed this horrific attack was to try and get people to react violently.
Hear my conversation with Jacinda Ardern now by searching for Conversations on the ABC Listen app.
If you're in government, there's a range of things you can do to shore up the chances of re-election.
You can run a strong campaign, you can decry your opponents, you can question the reliability of your whole election system.
Or you can just call off elections entirely. And we're about to tell you which country is doing just that. I'm Hamish McDonald.
And I'm Geraldine Doogue. Let's go global roaming.
Yes, Jerry, we're heading to Latin America on this episode, to Nicaragua precisely. We're also going to dip into some of the latest developments in AI because I know there's a lot of kind of looming, possible, terrible, world-ending things happening and maybe some of them might be coming to pass sooner rather than later. But let's start with Nicaragua and President Daniel Ortega. What's happening?
Well, he sort of basically told a press conference there will not be any more elections, and certainly he's, like, this speech is really railing against his longtime adversary, the United States. But for a lot of listeners of a certain age, we can remember Daniel Ortega going right back to 1979 when the Sandinistas, and he was the head of the Sandinistas, overthrew the dreadful Somoza dictatorship, and then they were just constantly on our front pages. And in effect, Ortega is a model of, can a revolutionary become a good governor? Because he became a governor. He lost power, then he's regained it. And here he is suspending all elections. So it's this amazing journey of Daniel Ortega that I think a lot of, it was really modelled on the Cubans. They were sort of completely inspired by the Cuban Revolution, and he came in after that. So Ortega has been around for many years, and here he is now making headlines in another way.
And of course, then that raises the question of what the United States might do and whether Venezuela and the implications of their decisions there might form or shape what Washington decides to do next. Very happily, one of our regulars, Jeremy Dicker, a former Australian diplomat, now the managing editor of International Intrigue, has also spent a bit of time in Nicaragua. So let's bring Jeremy in. Hello, Jeremy. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me back. Excited to roam.
Were you in Nicaragua for work or just pleasure?
Well, for work, but it was full of pleasure. I mean, it's an amazing place, great cigars, great rum, fascinating history, as the two of you just outlined. I was there when I was a baby diplomat stationed in Mexico City, and I went to Nicaragua. I must have gone a dozen times in about 3 years. So it's a place I know and love pretty well. And in fact, one of my visits, going back more than a decade, one of my visits was actually as an electoral observer for one of Daniel Ortega's elections, arguably the last sort of semi-fair, semi-free election that he deigned to allow.
I didn't even know, to be candid, whether he was alive. You know, he seemed to disappear. He came back and then he disappeared, and now he's made this speech. But there is talk that he's really not a well man. So can you help us out with that at all?
Yeah, he's now 80. He's looking really feeble. For years, we've all kind of quietly known that the real power behind the throne is actually his wife, Rosario. So much so that last year, Daniel Ortega, he actually appointed her as his co-president, which is not really a thing, but there you go. When you're a dictator, you can just make stuff up and appoint family members as co-president. But yeah, he's not doing well, and he was just completely absent from the public eye for months. No one saw him. He made zero public announcements until, just a few days ago on Sunday, when he came out into the capital city of Managua for the 47th anniversary of the Sandinista revolution that you mentioned. That's where the surprises just kept coming, because rather than just sort of wave at the crowd and, you know, go on his usual rant about gringos and Yankees and imperialists, he sort of suddenly announced that there's just going to be no more elections. And I think at first I thought, oh, maybe he's just going off on a bit of a tangent. He's maybe hit the Florida Kanye rum a little bit too hard or something. But no, he kind of unveiled this whole legislative plan to use his rubber stamp legislature to just stop elections. And it was a bit of a shock.
Jeremy, who were the Sandinistas? What did they want?
Yeah, the Sandinistas, they're named after a guy called Sandino, who more than a century ago was this sort of folk hero guerrilla who was fighting against US forces that were stationed in Nicaragua. And basically this leftist guerrilla group, the Sandinistas, formed, inspired by the original Sandino. Basically, they formed to topple what was then a US-backed dictatorship, a pretty brutal one run by the Somoza family. So that's kind of where Daniel Ortega first made his name, as this sort of guerrilla.
Hair.
Yes, exactly. Mm. This kind of romantic, you know, guerrilla in the jungles of Nicaragua, sweeping to power, toppling into dictatorship, and then winning a free and fair election, only a few years later. But his first term was actually pretty disastrous in the 80s. It was pretty disastrous. He suffered appalling inflation. The economy was stagnant, and the Nicaraguan people booted him out. So he'd spent 17 years off in the wilderness sort of waiting and plotting his comeback, which he eventually achieved in the elections of 2006.
We should say, I mean, again, this is where it's so interesting, a lot of listeners, that he was up against the United States all the time. I mean, there was basically Ronald Reagan and the Contras, you know, that again absolutely dominated our headlines, which is sort of a counter-revolutionary fight with some pretty nasty stuff, very nasty stuff in underway. So it was again that sort of classic example of can a small country trying to overthrow the status quo, which is backed by the superpower, really managed to come through. And I mean, Cuba's another example in a different way. Mm. That's what I think is so very interesting here, is that it sort of claimed Ortega. Well, I don't know what you think. It Ortega sort of battled on and on and on and became steadily more repressive himself, didn't he?
Yeah, he became...
He wasn't always like that.
No, it's almost cliched, sadly cliched, the way he sort of became the thing he spent his entire youth opposing. And to be fair, I mean, when I first started visiting Nicaragua as an Australian diplomat, this was sort of towards the end of his first term after re-election, so like 2010. He genuinely was popular at the time because Nicaragua's economy was flush with cheap Venezuelan oil, so it had this steady stream of cash. And so he would do these things like give a pig and a cow to a family, but do it, thousands of times across the country.
He did that whole effort to give people education too, didn't he? And to read books. There was that whole book reading exercise.
Yeah. So he was genuinely popular when I first started going there, but there were also folks genuinely worried that, he was going to become the very thing that he had spent all those years opposing. And, those critics have been vindicated because basically after that 2011 election, he just started systematically stripping back Nicaragua's elections, oppressing people, banning parties, exiling opponents. And it's been really sad to watch. It actually blew up in 2018. His sort of proposed pension reforms were really unpopular as his cheap Venezuelan oil started to run out. So there were these huge protests and, his goons ended up shooting dead hundreds of people on the streets of Managua. Just really shocking stuff. And it's just gotten worse and worse and worse. So as is often the case with these guys, that there is a kernel of truth and romanticism in the origin story. But I think when it comes to Daniel Ortega, that's long gone.
Jeremy, I don't know how plausible this is, but if I try to place myself in the mind of a Nicaraguan militant freedom fighter, whatever, turned president, I would imagine that Trump taking the president of Venezuela might start to reshape my thinking. How would it have done that for this guy?
Well, in a way, it confirms Ortega's thinking because he's built an entire brand and spent an entire life, campaigning against the gringos and the Yankees and the imperialists. And here it sort of arguably happens with Maduro, for example, in Venezuela. So, you know, certainly my gut was when this all started to play out. So, you know, Nicaragua has lost its cheap oil from Venezuela. It's lost a lot of the sort of security and intelligence support it used to get from Cuba. That's left what is the second poorest country in the Americas, after Haiti, by the way. Really poor country. It's left it incredibly vulnerable. And you would think a guy like Daniel Ortega would just lay low and hope no one notices while he and his family sort of dominate the economy and the political scene across the country. But he's sort of not really done that. I think, you know, by publicly declaring that there'll be no more elections, he's sort of thumbing his nose at an increasingly assertive America. And at the same time, he's done a few other moves with his other relationships that have drawn attention. He's sort of doubling down on his links with Russia. He, a few years ago, switched Nicaragua's recognition from Taiwan to China. So there's been quite a lot going on. Just the other day, he also cut formal diplomatic ties with Italy. And you got to wonder why is...
Why? What was all that about?
You got to wonder. Well, yeah, you got to wonder why a tiny, poor, distant country like Nicaragua is cutting ties with a European power like Italy. But it actually is a fascinating backstory dating back to 1978, when a former prime minister of Italy was actually kidnapped and murdered by a sort of leftist group called the Red Brigades.
Oh, this is Aldo Moro.
Yes, exactly. And one of the you know fugitives in that case ended up fleeing to Nicaragua. And weirdly, I mean, he's not hiding in the jungle somewhere. I mean, he's been there openly running a very popular Italian seafood restaurant. You can go and read TripAdvisor reviews for. And so, you know, rather than just handing this guy over to have his day in court, Nicaragua has spent decades.
Extraordinary.
Yeah. I'm starting to wonder. I want to go back and check my credit card statements and see if I actually went to that restaurant while I was there.
I was going to say, I'm pretty sure some diplomats would, you know, push that through on the expenses.
Wow.
Yeah, try the veal. Anyway, to go back to your question, Hamish, it has shaped Ortega's thinking, but nowhere near in the way that I would have guessed. And it's sort of putting Nicaragua.
So can we imagine this will, is it too small and too insignificant and inconsequential to attract Trump's attention there?
Yeah.
Because it's obviously got nothing much to offer, really.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the calculation that the Ortega family has made. I think partly this is just about cementing the family's power for whenever Ortega himself, passes away. As I mentioned, he's pretty frail. But I think also they've just calculated that Nicaragua itself is not big enough or annoying enough to really warrant the kind of interventions that, more prominent powers like Cuba and Venezuela have provoked. That being said, though, I mean, Managua is closer to LA than LA is to DC. So really, when you think about it, you know, geographically, that's real proximity there. And when you think about things that are at the top of Trump's mind, like irregular migration and drug trafficking, I mean, both of those are live challenges through that whole region, including Nicaragua. So, yeah, I can't see Trump going full Maduro on Nicaragua just yet, but there's been a steady stream of announcements of sanctions and other restrictions sort of increasingly expressing US displeasure.
You're listening to Global Rhyming from ABC's Radio National. Geraldine Doog is here, Hamish McDonald as well. Jeremy Dicker is the Managing Editor of International Intrigue. He's a former serving Australian diplomat. I want to talk to you a bit about AI this week as well, Jeremy, because you've been looking at something called Kimi K3 AI, which I've read about half a dozen stories on and I still don't entirely understand.
Yeah, Kimi K3, I wish they would come up with slightly more memorable names, but that's the latest one. I think, you know, the reason why it's generated so many articles and so many people really giving some thought to this is it's probably the third AI earthquake that's come out of China. The first, everyone might remember, was DeepSeek. The second, a little less prominent, was one called ZAI. And now this one, Moonshot. It was founded by, three guys out of China. One who actually did his PhD in the US, really interesting guy by the name of Yang Li Jin. The reason why his particular model has rattled so many people around the world, it's a few reasons. One is it's extremely powerful. I mean, there are all these tests that happen in the world of AI, you know, ranking which model is the best at math or science or reasoning or image generation. And this Kimi K3, it's actually performing really, really well, like as well as the sort of top tier US models, the brand names that we've all heard of. But the other reason that has really put it on the radar for many people around the world is just how efficient it is. It uses a fraction of the brain power that some of its US competitors use. It uses, 2% of its brain is sort of the stat that is doing the rounds. And so what that means is it's a lot cheaper, puts a lot less demands on folks who are using it, and makes it much, much more competitive when going head-to-head against US rivals.
Can I just interrupt you for a moment? Is this partly similarly with DeepSeek because it's more open source? Isn't this a very important part of it, that they're finding that the American systems, such as I can understand it, by the way, I don't want to go too far beyond my little tiny sliver of understanding, is much more closed. You enter it via sort of, portals that are governed by the companies, whereas it's much more of an open source method in China. Am I right there?
Well, yeah, that's certainly a big part of it. So if you think about it like having a car, the US models that we've all heard about, ChatGPT or Claude, that's like a rental model. You sort of pay to rent the AI. Whereas the interesting thing about something like Moonshot, Kimi K3, it's open weight, which means you own the car. And so you can sort of tweak it, localize it, secure it, do way more things with it, and all without having to route all your data through some pricey US tech overlord. So that also makes it really, really competitive. But one of the other interesting factors about all this is, these Chinese advances in efficiency, for example, they've not just happened accidentally or by some, niche process of innovation. They're actually a response to the fact that the US has now spent a few years precisely trying to limit China's access to US tech and computing power. And so what do you do when you've got strong limits to how much computing access you can get? Well, you start working really hard on coming up with clever ways to be more efficient with your AI. And so I guess one of the really sort of surprising and shocking things about this whole story is the fact that it's arguably an example of blowback. It's arguably the result of America's own attempts to try and curb China's access to top US tech.
Jeremy, the other interesting dynamic at play here, to my mind, is that the other big story this week around AI is the scenario where a ChatGPT, an OpenAI agent, basically jumped out of the fence, if you like, of its own system and started basically
dictating
hacking into another AI tool outside of human instruction, which is kind of the great fear. So you have a bit of the open geopolitical competition between the US and China occurring at the same time as the reticence of allowing the technology to get too far ahead to the extent that humans can no longer even control it.
Yes, and the results of that are just entirely unpredictable. So, the US has been seemingly more front-footed about trying to put some guardrails around this AI, which is why it runs those kind of tests in its own kind of sandpits to try and see what it might do before it goes and does it out in the real world. But in this case, when the victims of this hacking, a sort of tech portal called Hugging Face, once they realized what was going on and they tried to use US AI to defend themselves, those same guardrails were preventing their own ability to defend themselves. So they had to resort to models out of China to defend themselves against a hacking attempt by a US-based AI. So it's all very bewildering. And one of the reasons why it makes it so hard to really think more than a week or two in advance, given how quickly things are progressing in AI.
And is it correct that, this Moonshot, the parent company that of what you've just described, Anthropic had accused it in the past of actually tapping top US models to train Chinese versions? Because that's what, listening to you, going through that nicely, that sequence, you sort of think, well, how did they catch up so fast? Because we're given that whole story that this extraordinary rate of a pace of change is solely limited to the US, and then DeepSeek proved that was wrong. So, and this is just a further proof. How is it happening?
Well, exactly. You're exactly right. Anthropic, for a while, that's a big US AI company, has for a while been accusing three big Chinese AI companies, one of which is Moonshot. They've been distilling US AI and distilling.
Is that the phrase, distilling?
It basically means using someone else's AI to train and rapidly accelerate the progress of your own. And I mean, to an extent, a little bit of distilling is, I think, pretty standard in the industry to, you know, test and sharpen one model against another. But we're talking sort of, you know, the accusation is that it's large scale, industrial scale and deceptive, creating, you know, 25,000 fake accounts to try and maximize your access. So that's the accusation. The tricky thing about that accusation in this instance, though, is, you know, we're talking about a new Chinese model that is just as good as US models that only got released a few weeks ago.
Yes.
And typically that is not enough time to copy and paste an entire historic capability like what is being alleged in this case. The counter, though, is that there are, you know, sneaky little technical tricks. You just use a couple of very sharp reasoning threads and you can kind of reverse engineer this stuff really, really quickly. But even setting that aside, the reality is that a lot of what we're seeing in Kimi K3, it is genuinely innovative and new. For example, on the efficiency side that we're talking about, you know, only using 2% of the brain at any one time, that is genuinely innovative and new, and that's not being distilled from anywhere. So, you know, distillation, it's now, by the way, come straight out of the White House. A top Trump advisor is leveling that accusation at Moonshot. So, you know, maybe there's evidence that'll come out in the weeks ahead, but I don't know if it's the whole story here.
Jeremy, I wonder if you could offer a perspective on this. I heard something for the first time this week in relation to the growth of data centers here in Australia, that there is actually a geopolitical dimension to it, in that under the US legislation that governs AI in the US, if they want to put any of it elsewhere, it has to be in a Five Eyes country. Is that correct?
That's getting back to a Biden era policy, which was really trying to limit where US AI could be deployed and used. But Donald Trump has relaxed a lot of those rules. So certainly being a US ally is going to make Australia a lot more attractive for that large scale, you know, hyperscale data center build out. But beyond that, I mean, just the fact that we're a stable, democratic, you know, English speaking, we should theoretically have lots of cheap energy, lots of space to put these things, lots of reasons why we would already be an attractive partner. But the fact that we're a US ally, you know, opens a lot of legal avenues to ramp that up as well.
And as the government has sought to place more controls or at least frameworks around the rollout of data centres in Australia and AI more broadly, the government does seem to be making the case that there's sovereign interest in having these things here. And yet, as Ed Husic pointed out to me on Sydney Radio, we're still not actually pursuing sovereign AI capability, as in our own Australian-based AI large language models that do similar things. Is that a strategic risk in your view?
Absolutely. I mean, right now, almost the entire world is having to choose between two AI giants. One is China and one is the US. And Australia is no different in being caught between the two. And no amount of hosting the data centers that belong to and serve either a big US or a big Chinese AI company, no amount of data centers are going to change the reality that the fundamental algorithm at the heart of it, the models at the heart of it, the weights at the heart of it, you know, are ultimately designed and run and answer to someone overseas. So yeah, I think that's spot on. But we're not alone. There are some answers out there. You know, Latin American countries banded together to develop their own Latin American AI model. The Emiratis have been working on one. There are others out there, but the reality is that the performance is, there's still a big gap between what these sort of sovereign attempts can do and what, you know, the big Chinese and American models can do.
Well, Jeremy, congratulations, because you've made it clearer than most others have. I really applaud you. Thank you so much.
Every time I try and talk to Geraldine about it, that just I lose her. Clearly, I don't have the gift.
I'm struggling.
Listen, Jeremy, since you're here, I want to do a little bit of listener feedback, please, because there's a few stories I'm kind of keen to hear from you on. This has come in on a recent episode we did on the Pacific. It says, Hamish, Geraldine, team, enjoyed the recent episode on rugby league in the Pacific, rugby more broadly. Would love you to do more shows about the Pacific. It's such a vast and diverse region, right on our doorstep, often gets overlooked. Issues like energy security, transition, deep sea minerals, climate change, transnational crime, the rise of China. They've all got a unique Pacific Island perspective, given their own highly remote locations, yet often critical geostrategic alliances. I wonder how you're observing what's at play in the Pacific right now? Because we tend to report it from an Australian perspective, you know, whether it's the Nakamal agreement being done or rugby league diplomacy. The spin you get from the Australian government is that we're kind of striking some strategic wins. Is it as simple as that?
Yeah, it's a wonderful question, and I share that passion for the Pacific. I started my career in Fiji. I love it. The truth is, for decades, I think it was just seen as kind of peripheral for Australia. We're kind of more focused on the big powers, and we've sort of learnt the hard way, you know, a few years ago through that big Solomon Islands China security pact that shocked everyone, that this is not a region you can take for granted. You need to invest. And the reality is, I think Australia has been on a hot streak, a string of, you know, some. They haven't come easily. There've been some, you know, false starts, some near misses, but there are now real binding legal treaties between Australia and sort of four or five Pacific Island nations, and more to come, I'm sure. So I think the reality is Australia kind of got its act together, made amends, and is leaning into the types of things that Australia does best. One of which is, you know, you mentioned rugby league. I mean, the most popular sport by far in Papua New Guinea. No other country in the world can rival the fact that we have the biggest rugby league tournament in the world. And, you know, that's a heck of a carrot to be able to dangle to a nation like PNG to be a part of that. And I think it'll be good for the game.
But does it make any difference, though, if China's going to launch, you know, nuclear-capable intercontinental ballistic missiles in the backyard?
Yeah, I mean, that decision by China to test that ballistic missile was really quite a shock. And I think kind of ham-fisted diplomacy, to be honest. Because you've still got a dozen Pacific Island nations there thinking very carefully about the different options being presented by world powers, of which Australia is one. And I think to have them, you know, test a nuclear-capable missile in a nuclear-free zone, the Rarotonga Nuclear-Free Treaty, it's going to play very neatly into Australia's claims that, you know, maybe that's not necessarily the type of power you want to be doing long-term treaties with.
I must say, having seen the diplomatic outfit in Port Moresby when I was recently there before I went away to go to Papua New Guinea, I was certainly impressed by the fact that Australia is taking this super seriously. You know, a very big team looking at all sorts of different aspects.
What
very
were people
respectful.
Saying to you about it?
Oh, well, they were all in love with it. I've got to say that. Just like you say, Jeremy, sort of slightly passionate about the Pacific. And just that sense of looking at things that can be easily solved and some things that can't be easily solved and where Australia can best put its efforts. It was just the degree of commitment, I suppose.
Because there's few things I've heard you be as enthusiastic about in terms of Australia's foreign policy positioning as this. You came back from PNG a few months ago just full of life about PNG and rugby league.
I did. But the rugby league part is only part of it. But it was even more than that. It was that sense that this is a place that we've got a lot of common ground with, but also just this amazing, amazing polyglot culture that's there and how we work with it. I really felt it quite powerfully, the commitment from these Australian diplomats across the board.
Yeah, and it's a very senior posting for an Australian diplomat to have, high profile, and yeah, I got friends serving there now. The reality is, though, it's also just built on decades and decades of partnership and people-to-people links and history, you know, our World War II history, the Kokoda Trail. I mean, you know, Gareth Evans, our former foreign minister, used to talk about those sorts of things as like ballast for a relationship with another country. And, you know, we've got a lot of ballast with PNG, a lot of history, and that's
but
hard
for
anyone.
Nobody else does. Certainly China doesn't have the same ballast that we have.
Well, it's certainly hard to outshow that kind of ballast, absolutely.
Thanks very much to our producers on this episode, Aston Brown, supervising producer Pat Sunderland and executive producer Laura McAuliffe. Our email address is global.roaming@abc.net.au. Jeremy, it's been great to catch up with you. We'll look forward to roaming again soon.
Anytime.
Bye-bye, Jeremy.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listener.